There is so much that goes into one bottle of wine. So much time, so many resources, so much careful thought.
This big body of water, Lake Michigan, it has so much love to give us.
I was the young generation, now I'm the old one. It's funny how that happens, you know?
I'm adverse to publications of wine to some degree because the people that are writing these articles are living in a vacuum.
Americans have embraced wine more. We've become more of a wine culture.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 322. This week we feature Tom Mortimer of Lacadeau Vineyard in the Dundee Hills of Oregon. We truly believe a sense of humor keeps a winemaker going. Tom Mortimer made me laugh at every turn. Tom is proprietor of Lacadeau Vineyard in the Dundee Hills of Oregon, and considering how hard he's worked to grow grapes while keeping the birds away from the vineyard, among other threats, his humor is intact. We won't even talk about the raccoons. But he takes his wine seriously. We met with Tom at their tasting room, an elegantly appointed space featuring fine tastings and even some rocks. You can also listen to Tom on our Vino Lingo segment defining the wine term aromatics.
So I'm here with Tom Mortimer, and Tom is the owner of Lacadeau Winery, correct?
Correct, yep.
It was Lacadeau, right?
Lacadeau.
Lacadeau, yeah.
Close enough.
Yes, thank you, I appreciate that. You
sure.
Just gave me an out, that's pretty good.
Yep.
And we're at the tasting room, which is in the town of...
Dundee, Oregon.
It is actually in Dundee.
Yeah.
Cool, and obviously right behind us are the Dundee Hills.
That is correct.
So how are you doing today, Tom?
I am doing great. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you. Thank you very much for being here, and congratulations on your auction lot and a fantastic auction this year.
It was incredible. Yeah, $1 million raised for the Willamette Valley Winery Association.
It's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
So is this a shared tasting room, or is this your own tasting room? How does that work?
It is our own tasting room. We've been here about 5 years. And what we wanted to do is try to bring the vineyard to the tasting room, which is why the large mural aerial photograph is behind me. And hopefully we can talk a bit about the vineyard.
And we will. And it's interesting because of the vineyard is a bit of a distance, I guess, a difficult place to get to. Not unusual for vineyards, right?
It is 700 feet of elevation down a windy gravel road. Not that hard to get to. It's about a half hour from Portland, but not a great place to be on a rainy day like today.
Yeah, no climbing. We wouldn't have to climb, right?
No. We could drive there.
Okay, that's a good thing. It's a beautiful picture behind you. Stunning. How many acres are you farming?
Well, the total property is 28 acres. The planted acreage is about 17. Roughly 26,000 grapevines that we farm one at a time.
Yeah, one at a time. That's what farming's all about, isn't it?
Well, it is when you're trying to make good wine.
Yeah, yeah. And about how many cases are you producing?
Well, we do about 1,400 cases of Lacadeau. We have a couple of other brands, Aubuchon and Jolotet. We do another 3,000 cases or so of those. So in total, 4,000, 4,500.
So is that exclusively Pinot, or are you making other wines?
We're making other wines. We do, within the Lacadeau Vineyard, the estate wines, we do Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. The first Chardonnay will be coming out this summer. We'll be bottling the 2017. And then under the Aubuchon brand, we do Pinot Gris. We do also Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Walla Walla Grenache. And in the Jolotet product line, we do Pinot Gris and Pinot Noir, and also Cabernet from Walla Walla.
Okay, now we get this question a lot from my listeners. Why so many different labels, or why so many different brands?
Well, the purpose of Lacadeau is to keep it very pure and very specific in that it is a single vineyard, 100% estate wine. So if it says Lucchetto on the label, the fruit was grown by us at our estate vineyard site. Under the Aubuchon label, we begin to bring in fruit from other vineyards. The nice part about that is we can go anywhere we want. We can work with any varietal that we want, so there's a tremendous amount of flexibility, but we wanted to separate that from Lucchetto. Under the Jolité brand, that wine is designed to be more of a retail product, generally in the under $30 category. And so we just wanted to differentiate that from our premium wines, which tend to be small production, very artisanal products.
So it's a very specific marketing plan.
Absolutely.
Great. Yep. Yeah, it sounds like a smart way to go. So for you, how long have you been in the wine business?
Well, it depends where you start the clock. My wife likes to start the clock when I wrote the first check, and that was 1997. That's when we bought the vineyard property. It was completely raw ground. It had been logged off. They left us the second growth fir tree stumps, which were about 4 feet in diameter.
Oh, I bet that was fun removing those.
That was very fun. I learned about splitters on the back of a D8 cat. Lots of fun. We cleared the property for a couple of years. We planted in 1999. First production was 2002. The Lucchetto vintage, the 2002 vintage, came to market in 2005. So again, you can either start in 97, you could start with the vintage of 02, or you can start when I actually sold something, which was 2005.
Which goes back to the thing we've talked about hundreds of times for our listeners, is this idea of when you start a winery versus when you actually sell a bottle. That doesn't connect to the word profit at all, though.
No, it's pretty much an 8-year open wallet experience. You just kind of take out your billfold and you say, hey, take what you want. And hopefully there's enough in there to pay for the bulldozer, pay for the grapevines, pay for the trellis, pay for the winemaking, and then buy all the packaging. It is not a business that anybody gets too quickly.
Which leads me to the question, gee, why did you do this?
That's a really good question. You know, I love wine, and I fell in love with Oregon, and the two came together. We decided to find a beautiful property, which we did. When I began thinking about how do you landscape 28 acres, the only thing I could come up with was the idea that a vineyard would do a pretty good job of that. So we began planting. Fortunately, the vineyard's all broken volcanic basalt, and our first fruit was incredibly good. And we made some beautiful wine, and it was very well received, and so we kept planting, and here we are.
Wow. And I'm assuming, I see a house on the photo behind us. Is that where you live?
We do in the summertime. It's a small house. Originally, we were living in Minneapolis. We commuted out here for 12 years before
Wow.
we actually moved here full time. That was because my wife said, I will move when you show me that it's real. Mm. And since it took 8 years to produce a bottle, took about another 4 years, 5 years before we actually had a business going. And then after 12 years, she said, okay, it's real, I'll move. And we did. We came out here in 2009. But we tend to stay at the house in the summer. And then we live down in Newburgh in the winter when it's kind of drippy and rainy.
Yeah, I would imagine up there probably a little bit rough. It's really, I mean, just to stand here and talk to you, it's hard not to just stare at the map, because it really, hard not to stare at the photo. It's stunning, stunningly beautiful.
It is a beautiful place.
About how many feet is that?
It's at 730 feet of elevation. It's a south slope with an east-west roll that looks 50 miles down the Willamette Valley. At night, the stars come out, and Salem lights up, and all the lights in the valley light up. It's truly a beautiful place.
I can imagine. I'm sure you have lots of photographs of that, don't you?
Probably way too many.
Yeah, I'm sure. Nothing wrong with that. So that first vintage, I like to ask winemakers, you know, what they keep back, but especially the first vintage is a bit more of a challenge because you're still trying to make a buck. So do you still have any of that?
A couple bottles, just a few. But and surprisingly, they're actually doing pretty well. Young vines usually don't age very well, but I mentioned earlier, we're planted on all broken volcanic basalt, and our wines tend to have a little more structure. We've been fortunate. They age quite nicely, and so, yeah, we still have a few of the originals.
So before you became a winemaker, what did you do?
Well, my business was paper, packaging, and recycling. Initially worked for a couple of big paper companies, packaging companies, and then about 20 years ago bought a recycling business that collected packaging from large plastic and mineral producers, companies like DuPont, and we cleaned up the packaging, refurbished it, and sold it back to DuPont. We kept about 7 million pounds of plastic out of the landfill every year.
Wow. That had to be, and this is a very ignorant question, so forgive me, a very scientific process to be able to turn this into something usable.
Well, yes and no. I refer to it as recycling. Technically, it was more of a refurbishing company, and the scientific process would typically be more in the recycling side of things, where you're taking a material and you're converting it into a completely new product. What we were doing is recovering used packaging, cleaning up the packaging, repackaging it, organizing it, sending it back to the original user for reuse. So if you want to get environmental about it, we were one step up on the ladder because a lot less energy and a lot less waste.
Interesting. Well, that's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
Yeah. So I'm a little curious, being here at that altitude, do you run into problems with any kind of critters, animals? I mean, and do you have bird problems up there?
We do. The biggest bird problems we have are that there are a lot of flickers and they keep trying to eat our house. But apart from that, flickers are kind of overgrown brown and orange woodpeckers, and they fly like little fighter planes, but the guys like to show off for the girls, and in every spring they come and chew on the side of our house and drill holes. But we have plenty of other birds. We're surrounded 360 degrees by forest, and then we foolishly left some fir trees in the middle of the vineyard, and the net result was we have a lot of birds, so we net the vineyard, and then we also put up a lot of electronic chirpers and things of that sort.
Sure. So let's talk about this netting for a moment, which fascinates me, because netting from a physical point of view to me is simply mind-blowing. It's incredibly intensive.
It's all manual labor to put it on. Of course, you've got to buy the netting, and you net both sides of the vine. So we have a lot of rolls of bird netting around, and you put it on. And the worst part about bird netting is that you then have to take it off. You know, putting it on, you kind of feel like you're doing something that makes sense. You know, you're protecting the vines from the birds. When you take it off, it kind of feels like you're just wasting money.
Yeah.
But that's the way it goes.
Is it reusable?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, the biggest cost for the bird netting is the labor to put it on and to take it off.
Yeah, I thought about that.
It's gotten worse and worse and worse. As labor costs have gone up.
Does the audio aspect, I think you call it bird chirpers, does that actually work too?
It does. It has a way of making the living environment up there rather tedious. It's about 4 weeks where you feel like there are birds all around you that are having their wings pulled off and they're making horrible sounds. In reality, it's just the electronic chirpers that are predator birds that are trying to scare away the non-predator birds. And then we also put out air cannons. One of the good things about being surrounded by trees is that it keeps the noise in the vineyard, so my neighbors don't go crazy when I set up 4 or 5 propane cannons like you sometimes see at an airport.
Sure, yeah.
So between the cannons, the chirpers, and the bird netting, we really don't have too many bird problems.
I only wish you had a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. In 2010 there was There were a lot of birds that came in. It was a late vintage. Birds come in later in the season when they're coming down and they're foraging and they're looking for food. And so if you're picking early in mid-September, late September, there's a few local birds around, but they have blackberries to eat and other stuff. And, you know, the locals aren't too bad. It's when the ones come migrating down that they can clean off the whole vineyard in a little bit of time. And there were a lot of people who lost a lot of fruit in 2010. But because we are so vigilant about bird control, 2010 was kind of a non-event for us. We just did what we do.
Yeah, it's crazy.
No, it is. Yeah, and then, you know, for the house, we run a string across and we put up red and silver mylar film that looks like, you know, kind of the tentacles of an octopus draped across the front of the house that blow in the wind. And, you know, I think if you didn't know any better, you'd think there was a great party going on. But yeah. Hopefully the flickers don't feel that way.
Yeah, I hope not. And in the end, it just goes to show how easy it is to make wine. No big deal, right?
No big deal. No, you just got to have a little fruit left in order to do it.
That would be really helpful. Boy, especially when Mother Nature comes in, because this is what they want. They're part of that whole process.
Well, that's true. And of course, if there's any fruit left, if you're really lucky, it'll get rained on and the berries will pop and then you and then you'll get disease pressure. And we did have some raccoons come in one year that started eating the fruit.
Oh, even better.
Well, I thought it was birds, but my vineyard manager is a great guy. He's been doing it for a long time, and he goes, birds don't eat from the bottom up.
That makes sense.
They eat from the top down. And he said, you're missing the bottoms of your clusters on the lower level. So I think you've got some little furry critters that are walking through the vineyard at night eating the bottoms of the clusters.
Free food, just helping themselves.
Well, you know, at least we don't have bears.
Yeah, good point. Well, I won't ask how you got rid of those. We'll just kind of move on from that.
Yep.
Do you have? I know some wineries in California have run into issue with wild pigs. Have you run into any of that at all?
We do not have any wild pigs. No,
well, that's a good thing. Well, geez, at least one thing's easy for you in life.
That is true.
Yeah. So considering the length of time you've been in the business, I'm not really trying to be negative, and this could be a positive thing too. What drives you crazy about the wine business?
Well, the thing about wine is that it's incredibly transactional. And not every customer is the same. And not every customer is equally passionate about wine. And frankly, not every customer is able to afford wine like other customers. And so the combination of knowledge, enthusiasm, you know, economic capability means that you can spend a lot of time and maybe sell one bottle of wine or maybe not sell any bottles of wine. On the other hand, we do run into people that get incredibly enthusiastic and, you know, they're like, hey, load the trunk. And those are good days.
Yeah, well, those are good people too. Anybody who loves wine like that. So this is a question I've been asking over the course of the last year, and it's been a fun question to ask, so I'll give you a moment to think about it afterwards. But not too long, Tom.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. You know, for the time you've been in the wine business, what's the question that you've never been asked, or that you haven't been asked, that you'd like to be asked?
Wow. That's a tough question. The question I've never been asked that I would like to be asked. Yeah, of course, with me, the question is always sometimes whether, it doesn't matter whether a question got asked, I'll probably tell you anyhow. So, but I think, you know, the thing that I like to talk about, and sometimes we get asked, but sometimes I just talk about it, and that is the connection of the finished product to the various elements of the land, the different variables, and the continuum of the whole process. So, you know, you start with dirt, obviously, and then you can have plants and you have to do farming. But you end up with rootstocks and clones that are part of the variables. You have all kinds of canopy management and farming issues, irrigation issues throughout the season. And then you get the fruit into the winery. And the question is, then what? And one of the things we've been working on a lot lately, we hired a consultant from Burgundy, a guy by the name of Pierre Millman, who comes over a couple times a year. And the goal for Pierre was to really work on aromatics. And the thing about aromatics is that we often treat them as an afterthought, kind of like a lightning strike. Gee, the wine either does or doesn't have it. It's a light switch. It's column A, it's column B. But the question really is, the aromatics didn't happen by accident. It came from somewhere. And I think, we don't get asked a lot about aromatics. People comment on it. But I think the topic's pretty fascinating.
That was a really good answer. Thank you.
Well, good. Well, yeah. I got one right.
Your grades will be in the mail for you a little bit later.
All right, good.
Well, now comes the very common question. I'm sure you get asked a lot, but I'm always curious about, what do you drink? What do you like to drink? What's your favorite?
Very good question. I've known a lot of people who collect wine. Obviously, we have customers, but I have a lot of friends. I got into the wine business because I started collecting wine and wanted to take it to the next level. I find people that are passionate about a wine, they kind of get to a fork in the road. They either fill their basement with wine that other people made, or they go start making it. And I unfortunately did both. But the collectors that I know seem to come in two forms. There are people that buy one, two, or three bottles, and they buy one, two, or three bottles of everything that's exciting that they can possibly think of. And then there's other types of collectors that when something gets a big score or they try a bottle of wine that they can't live without, they go out and they buy 10 cases. And those folks obviously don't have as many items in their cellar, but they have a lot of depth. I tend to be like the former, and so I've got a few bottles of this and a few bottles of that. I love Hermitage. I love Pinot Noir, certainly, Burgundy. Probably the biggest non-domestic part of my cellar is Italian. Piedmont wines in particular. And more recently, a lot of whites. I love whites from Loire. Love aged dry German Rieslings. I love Alsatian aged Gewürztraminers from nice vineyards. I'm kind of an equal opportunity drinker as long as it's from a good site and it's well made.
I'd like to hang out with you sometime.
Okay. Yeah, let's start.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming, obviously, you're here, you spend time visiting with your guests and talking with them about wine.
For sure.
And yeah. And part of what you do when you're in a tasting room is education. Is there any of your own personal inside tips you like to give people, especially people who are newer, who are just learning about wines?
Absolutely. I think the one thing is that we all go through a continuum of trying to understand wine and decide what we like and then try to figure out what is the difference between good wine and not so good wine. Early on, the difference is simply, gee, I liked that one, that's good wine. I didn't like that one, that's not good wine. But we've all had situations where we've had a good wine that we didn't like, and we've had a wine that wasn't supposed to be a good wine that we liked quite a bit. So it can get confusing, and I think that my message would be to stay focused on your own palate. As Shakespeare said, to thine own self be true. What we see happening a lot in the tasting room is people will come in and they will have read scores in a magazine or a journal. And they may have been somebody else's scores and they're insistent that that had to be the very best wine. But then they'll try one of our wines that maybe didn't have as big of a score, and they'll like it better. And that tends to confound people. Oppositely, they might come in and try one of our wines that had a big score, and they might not like it as well as one of the other wines we made. So I think the key is to trust your palate and buy the wines you like.
Good words. I completely agree. So your tasting room here, is this by appointment, or can people just wander on in? Or
people can wander on in. We're open 7 days a week. Open a little bit leisurely on Sunday at 1 o'clock. Otherwise, it's pretty much 10 to 5 every day. And if you show up at 5, we'll be here till 6. So,
yeah.
Happy to see anybody anytime.
That's the hospitality of the wine business. That's the great thing about it. Well, not too many businesses would do that, you know.
It's true. Yeah. Because we're not at a vineyard site, we tend to get a lot of late afternoon traffic. People are coming down the hills and they're on their way back and they want to squeeze one more gulp in. And so we tend to load up at 4:30 in the afternoon, and people show up at 5:05, and we stay here till 6:30, and that's the way it works.
And you meet some fun people in the process too, I bet.
We meet great people. Yeah. People nice. Are wonderful.
And for our listeners who'd like to learn about you online, what is your website?
Website is www.lucadovineyard.com.
Excellent. You're a total pleasure to talk to. You have a great sense of humor and in a very wry way, which is fun. So thank you very much for taking the time for us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ray. Appreciate it.
Learn more by visiting lucadovineyard.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.